Disc 4.
I lay awake for an hour or more. Night magnified the quiet of the city, making the sounds which broke it the more desolate. From time to time voices rose from the street, edgy and brittle with hysteria. Once there came a freezing scream which seemed to revel horribly in its release from sanity. Somewhere not far away a sobbing went on endlessly, hopelessly. Twice I heard the sharp reports of single pistol shots. I gave heartfelt thanks to whatever it was that had brought Josella and me together for companionship. Complete loneliness was the worst state I could imagine just then. Alone one would be nothing. Company meant purpose, and purpose helped to keep the morbid fears at bay. I tried to shut out the sounds by thinking of all the things I must do the next day, the day after, and the days after that, by guessing what the beam of light might mean and how it might affect us. But the sobbing in the background went on, and on, reminding me of the things I had seen that day, and would see tomorrow. The opening of the door brought me sitting up in sudden alarm. It was Josella, carrying a lighted candle. Her eyes were wide and dark, and she had been crying.
"I can't sleep," she said. "I'm frightened. Horribly frightened. Can you hear them? All those poor people. I can't stand it."
She came like a child for comfort. I'm not sure that her need of it was much greater than mine. She fell asleep before I did, with her head resting on my shoulder. Still, the memories of the day would not leave me in peace. But in the end, one does sleep. My last recollection was of the sweet, sad voice of the girl who had sung, "So we'll go no more a-roving."
Chapter 6. Rendezvous.
When I awoke, I could hear Josella already moving around in the kitchen. My watch said nearly 7 o'clock. By the time I had shaved uncomfortably in cold water and dressed myself, there was a smell of toast and coffee drifting through the apartment. I found her holding a pan over the oil stove. She had an air of self-possession which was hard to associate with the frightened figure of the night before. Her manner was practical, too.
"Canned milk, I'm afraid. The fridge stopped. Everything else is all right, though," she said.
It was difficult for a moment to believe that the expediently dressed form before me had been the ballroom vision of the previous evening. She had chosen a dark blue skiing suit with white-topped socks rolled above sturdy shoes. On a dark leather belt she wore a finely made hunting knife to replace the mediocre weapon I had found the day before. I have no idea how I expected to find her dressed, nor whether I had given the matter any thought, but the practicality of her choice was by no means the only impression I received as I saw her.
"Will I do, do you think?"
she said. "Eminently," I assured her. I looked down at myself. "I wish I'd had as much forethought. Gents' lounge suiting isn't quite the rig for the job," I added.
"You could do better," she agreed, with a candid glance at my crumpled suit. "That light last night," she went on, "came from the university tower. At least I'm pretty sure it did. There's nothing else noticeable exactly on that line. It seems about the right distance, too."
I went into her room and looked along the scratch I had drawn on the sill. It did, as she said, point directly at the tower. And I noticed something more. The tower was flying two flags on the same mast. One might have been left hoisted by chance, but two must be a deliberate signal, the daytime equivalent of the light. We decided over breakfast that we would postpone our planned program and make investigation of the tower our first job for the day. We left the flat about half an hour later. As I had hoped, the station wagon, by standing out in the middle of the street, had escaped the attention of prowlers and was intact. Without delaying further, we dropped the suitcases that Josella had acquired into the back among the Triffid gear and started off. Few people were about. Presumably weariness and the chill in the air had made them aware that night had fallen, and not many had yet emerged from whatever sleeping places they had found. Those who were to be seen were keeping more to the gutters and less to the walls than they had on the previous day. Most of them were now holding sticks or bits of broken wood with which they tapped their way along the curb. It made for easier going than by the house fronts with their entrances and projections, and the tapping had decreased the frequency of collisions. We threaded our way with little difficulty, and after a time turned into Store Street to see the University Tower at the end of it rising straight before us. "Steady," said Josella, as we turned into the empty road. "I think there's something happening at the gates." She was right. As we came nearer, we could see a not inconsiderable crowd beyond the end of the street. The previous day had given us a distaste for crowds. I swung right down Gower Street, ran on for 50 yards or so, and stopped. "What do you reckon's going on there? Do we investigate or clear out?" I asked.
"I'd say investigate," Josella replied promptly.
"Good, me too," I agreed.
"I remember this part," she added. "There's a garden behind these houses. If we can get in there, we ought to be able to see what's happening without mixing ourselves up in it."
We left the car and started peering hopefully into basement areas. In the third, we found an open door. A passage straight through the house led into the garden. The place was common to a dozen or so houses, and curiously laid out, being for the most part at the level of the basements, and thus below that of the surrounding streets. But on the far side, that closest to the university building, it rose to a kind of terrace separated from the road by tall iron gates and a low wall. We could hear the sound of the crowd beyond it as a kind of composite murmur. We crossed the lawn, made our way up a sloped gravel path, and found a place behind a screen of bushes whence we could watch. The crowd that stood in the road outside the university gates must have numbered several hundred men and women. It was larger than the sound of it had led us to expect, and for the first time I realized how much quieter and more inactive a crowd of blind people is than a comparably sized crowd of the sighted. It is natural, of course, for they must depend almost entirely on their ears to know what is happening, so that the quietness of each is to the advantage of all. But it had not been obvious to me until that moment. Whatever was going on was right at the front. We managed to find a slightly higher mound which gave us a view of the gates across the heads of the crowd. A man in a cap was talking volubly through the bars. He did not appear to be making a lot of headway, for the part taken in the conversation by the man on the other side of the gates consisted almost entirely of negative headshakes.
"What is it?" Josella asked in a whisper.
I helped her up beside me. The talkative man turned so that we had a glimpse of his profile. He was, I judged, about 30, with a straight, narrow nose and rather bony features. What showed of his hair was dark, but it was the intensity of his manner that was more noticeable than his appearance. As the colloquy through the gates continued to get nowhere, his voice became louder and more emphatic, though without visible effect on the other. There could be no doubt that the man beyond the gates was able to see. He was doing so watchfully, through horn-rimmed glasses. A few yards behind him stood a little knot of 3 more men about whom there was equally little doubt. They, too, were regarding the crowd and its spokesman with careful attention. The man on the outside grew more heated. His voice rose as if he were talking as much for the benefit of the crowd as for those behind the railings.
"Now listen to me," he said angrily. "These people here have got just as much bloody right to live as you have, haven't they? It's not their fault they're blind, is it? It's nobody's fault. But it's going to be your fault if they starve, and you know it."
His voice was a curious mixture of the rough and the educated, so that it was hard to place him, as though neither style seemed quite natural to him somehow.
"I've been showing them where to get food. I've been doing what I can for them, but Christ, there's only one of me, and there's thousands of them. You could be showing them where to get food too, but are you, hell? What are you doing about it? Damn all, that's what. Just sweet F.A., but look after your own lousy skins. I met your kind before. It's damn you, Jack, I'm all right, that's your motto."
He spat with contempt, and raised a long oratorical arm. "Out there," he said, waving his hand towards London at large.
"Out there, there are thousands of poor devils only wanting someone to show them how to get the food that's there for the taking. And you could do it. All you've got to do is show them. But do you? Do you, you buggers? No, what you do is shut yourselves in here and let them bloody well starve, when each of you could keep hundreds alive by doing no more than coming out and showing the poor sods where to get the grub. God almighty, aren't you people human?"
The man's voice was violent. He had a case to put, and he was putting it passionately. I felt Josella's hand unconsciously clutching my arm, and I put my hand over hers. The man on the far side of the gate said something that was inaudible where we stood.
How long? Shouted the man on our side. How in hell would I know how long the food's going to last? What I do know is that if bastards like you don't muck in and help, there ain't going to be many left alive by the time they come in to clear this bloody mess up.
He stood glaring for a moment.
Fact of it is, you're scared. Scared to show 'em where the food is. And why? Because the more these poor devils get to eat, the less there's going to be for your lot. That's the way of it, isn't it? That's the truth, if you had the guts to admit it.
Again, we failed to hear the answer of the other man. But whatever it was, it did nothing to mollify the speaker. He stared back grimly through the bars for a moment. Then he said,
All right, if that's the way you want it.
He made a lightning snatch between the bars and caught the other's arm. In one swift movement, he dragged it through and twisted it. He grabbed the hand of a blind man standing beside him and clamped it on the arm.
Hang on there, mate,
he said, and jumped towards the main fastening of the gates. The man inside recovered from his first surprise. He struck wildly through the bars behind him with his other hand. A chance swipe took the blind man in the face. It made him give a yell and tighten his grip. The leader of the crowd was wrenching at the gate fastening. At that moment, a rifle cracked. The bullet pinged against the railings and whirred off on a ricochet. The leader checked suddenly, undecided. Behind him there was an outbreak of curses and a scream or two. The crowd swayed back and forth as though uncertain whether to run or to charge the gates. The decision was made for them by those in the courtyard. I saw a youngish-looking man tuck something under his arm, and I dropped down, pulling Gisella with me as the clatter of a submachine gun began. It was obvious that the shooting was deliberately high. Nevertheless, the rattle of it and the whiz of glancing bullets was alarming. One short burst was enough to settle the matter. When we raised our heads, the crowd had lost entity, and its components were groping their ways to safer parts in all three possible directions. The leader paused only to shout something unintelligible. Then he turned away too. He made his way northwards up Mallet Street, doing his best to rally his following behind him. I sat where we were and looked at Gisella. She looked thoughtfully back at me, and then down at the ground before her. It was some minutes before either of us spoke. Well? I asked, at last. She raised her head to look across the road, and then at the last stragglers from the crowd pathetically fumbling their ways.
He was right, she said. You know he was right, don't you?
I nodded.
Yes, he was right. And yet he was quite wrong, too. You see, there is no they to come to clear up this mess. I'm quite sure of that now. It won't be cleared up. We could do as he says. We could show some, though only some, of these people where there is food. We could do that for a few days, maybe for a few weeks. But after that, what?
It seems so awful, so callous. If we face it squarely, there's a simple choice, I said. Either we can set out to save what can be saved from the wreck, and that has to include ourselves, or we can devote ourselves to stretching the lives of these people a little longer. That is the most objective view I can take. But I can see, too, that the more obviously humane course is also probably the road to suicide. Should we spend our time in prolonging misery when we believe that there is no chance of saving the people in the end? Would that be the best use to make of ourselves? She nodded slowly.
Put like that, there doesn't seem to be much choice, does there? And even if we could save a few, which are we going to choose? And who are we to choose? And how long could we do it anyway?
There's nothing easy about this, I said. I've no idea what proportion of semi-disabled persons it may be possible for us to support when we come to the end of handy supplies, but I don't imagine it could be very high.
You've made up your mind, she said, glancing at me. There might or might not have been a tinge of disapproval in her voice. My dear, I said, I don't like this any more than you do. I've put the alternatives boldly before you. Do we help those who have survived the catastrophe to rebuild some kind of life? Or do we make a moral gesture which, on the face of it, can scarcely be more than a gesture?
The people across the road there evidently intend to survive. She dug her fingers into the earth and let the soil trickle out of her hand.
I suppose you're right, she said.
But you're right when you say I don't like it.
Our likes and dislikes as decisive factors have now pretty well disappeared, I suggested.
Maybe. But I can't help feeling that there must be something wrong about anything that starts with shooting.
He shot to miss, and it's very likely he saved fighting, I pointed out. The crowd had all gone now. I climbed over the wall and helped Josella down on the other side. A man at the gate opened it to let us in.
How many of you?
He asked.
Just two of us. We saw your signal last night, I told him.
Okay, come along, we'll find the colonel, he said, leading us across the forecourt.
The man whom he called the colonel had set himself up in a small room not far from the entrance and intended, seemingly, for the porters. He was a chubby man just turned 50 or thereabout. His hair was plentiful but well-trimmed and grey. His moustache matched it and looked as if no single hair would dare to break the ranks. His complexion was so pink, healthy and fresh that it might have belonged to a much younger man. His mind, I discovered later, had never ceased to do so. He was sitting behind a table with quantities of paper arranged on it in mathematically exact blocks, and an unsoiled sheet of pink blotting paper placed squarely before him. As we came in, he turned upon us, one after the other, an intense, steady look, and held it a little longer than was necessary. I recognized the technique. It is intended to convey that the user is a percipient judge accustomed to taking summarily the measure of his man. The receiver should feel that he now faces a reliable type with no nonsense about him, or, alternatively, that he has been seen through and had all his weaknesses noted. The right response is to return it in kind, and to be considered a useful fella. I did. The colonel picked up his pen.
Your names, please?
We gave them.
And addresses?
In the present circumstances, I fear they won't be very useful, I said. But if you really feel you must have them. We gave them too. He murmured something about system, organization, and relatives and wrote them down. Age, occupation, and all the rest of it followed. He bent his searching look upon us again, scribbled a note upon each piece of paper, and put them in a file.
Need good men. Nasty business, this. Plenty to do here, though. Plenty. Mr. Beadley'll tell you what's wanted.
We came out into the hall again. Josella giggled. He forgot to ask for references in triplicate, but I gather we've got the job, she said. Michael Beadley, when we discovered him, turned out to be in decided contrast. He was lean, tall, broad-shouldered, and slightly stooping with something of the air of an athlete run to books. In repose, his face took on an expression of mild gloom from the darkness of his large eyes, but it was seldom that one had a glimpse of it in repose. The occasional streaks of grey in his hair helped very little in judging his age. He might have been anything between 35 and 50. His obvious weariness just then made an estimate still more difficult. By his looks, he must have been up all night. Nevertheless, he greeted us cheerfully and waved an introductory hand towards a young woman who took down our names again as we gave them.
Sandra Telmont, he explained. Sandra's our professional remembrancer. Continuity is her usual work, so we regard it as particularly thoughtful of Providence to contrive her presence here just now.
The young woman nodded to me and looked harder at Josella. We've met before, she said thoughtfully. She glanced down at the pad on her knee. Presently a faint smile passed across her pleasant though unexotic countenance.
Oh, yes, of course, she said in recollection.
What did I tell you? The thing clings like a flypaper, Josella observed to me.
What's this about? Inquired Michael Beadley.
I explained. He turned a more careful scrutiny on Josella. She sighed.
Please forget it, she suggested. I'm a bit tired of living it down.
That appeared to surprise him agreeably.
All right,
he said, and dismissed the matter with a nod. He turned back to the table.
Now to get on with things. You've seen Jack.
If that is the colonel who is playing at civil service, we have, I told him.
He grinned.
"Well, got to know how we stand. Can't get anywhere without knowing a ration strength,"
he said in a fair imitation of the colonel's manner. "It's quite true, though," he went on. "I'd better give you just a rough idea of how things do stand. Up to the present, there are about 35 of us, all sorts. We hope and expect that some more will come in during the day. Out of those here now, 28 can see. The others are wives or husbands, and there are 2 or 3 children who cannot. At the moment, the general idea is that we move away from here sometime tomorrow if we can be ready in time. To be on the safe side, you understand?" I nodded. "We'd decided to get away this evening for the same reason," I told him. "What have you for transport?" I explained the present position of the station wagon. "We were going to stock up today," I added. "So far, we've practically nothing except a quantity of anti-Triffid gear." He raised his eyebrows. The girl, Sandra, also looked at me curiously. "That's a queer thing to make your first essential," he remarked. I told them the reasons. Possibly I made a bad job of it, for they neither of them looked much impressed. He nodded casually and went on. "Well, if you're coming in with us, here's what I suggest. Bring in your car, dump your stuff, then drive off and swap it for a good big lorry. Then, does either of you know anything about doctoring?" he broke off to ask. We shook our heads. He frowned a little. "That's a pity. So far we've got no one who does. It'll surprise me if we're not needing a doctor before long. And anyway, we ought all of us to have inoculations. Still, it's not much good sending you two off on a medical supplies scrounge. What about food and general stores, suit you?" He flipped through some pages on a clip, detached one of them and handed it to me. It was headed number 15, and below was a tight list of canned goods, pots and pans, and some bedding. "Not rigid," he said, "but keep reasonably close to it and we'll avoid too many duplications. Stick to best quality. With the food, concentrate on value for bulk. I mean, even if cornflakes are your leading passion in life, forget 'em. I suggest you keep to warehouses and big wholesalers." He took back the list and scribbled 2 or 3 addresses on it. "Cans and packets are your food line. Don't get led away by sacks of flour, for instance. There's another party on that sort of stuff." He looked thoughtfully at Gisella. "Heavyish work, I'm afraid, but it's the most useful job we can give you at present. Do as much as you can before dark. There'll be a general meeting and discussion here about 9:30 this evening." As we turned to go, "Got a pistol?" he asked. "I didn't think of it," I admitted. "Better, just in case. Quite effective simply fired into the air," he said. He took 2 pistols from a drawer in the table and pushed them across. "Less messy than that," he added, with a look at Gisella's handsome knife. "Good scrounging to you." Even by the time we set off after unloading the station wagon, we found that there were still fewer people about than on the previous day. The ones that were showed an inclination to get on the pavements at the sound of the engine rather than to molest us. The first lorry to take our fancy proved useless, being filled with wooden cases too heavy for us to remove. Our next find was luckier, a 5-tonner, almost new and empty. We transshipped and left the station wagon to its fate. At the first address on my list, the shutters of the loading bay were down, but they gave way without much difficulty to the persuasions of a crowbar from a neighbouring shop, and rolled up easily. Inside, we made a find. 3 lorries stood backed up to the platform. One of them was fully loaded with cases of canned meat. "Can you drive one of these things?" I asked Gisella. She looked at it. "Well, I don't see why not. General idea is the same, isn't it? And there's certainly no traffic problem." We decided to come back and fetch it later, and took the empty lorry onto another warehouse where we loaded parcels of blankets, rugs, and quilts, and then went on further to acquire a noisy miscellany of pots, pans, cauldrons, and kettles. When we had it filled, we felt we'd put in a good morning's work on a job that was heavier than we had thought. We satisfied the appetite it had given us at a small pub hitherto untouched. The mood which filled the business and commercial districts was gloomy, though it was a gloom that still had more the style of a normal Sunday or public holiday than of collapse. Very few people at all were to be seen in those parts. Had the catastrophe come by day, instead of by night after the workers had gone home, it would have been a hideously different scene. When we had refreshed ourselves, we collected the already loaded lorry from the food warehouse and drove the 2 of them slowly and uneventfully back to the university. We parked them in the forecourt there and set off again. About 6:30 we returned once more with another pair of well-loaded lorries and a feeling of useful accomplishment. Michael Beadley emerged from the building to inspect our contributions. He approved of it all, save half a dozen cases that I had added to my second load. "What are they?" he asked. "Triffid guns and bolts for them," I told him. He looked at me thoughtfully. "Oh, yes, you arrived with a lot of anti-Triffid stuff," he remarked. "I think it's likely we'll need it," I said. He considered. I could see that I was being put down as a bit unsound on the subject of Triffids. More likely he was accounting for that by the bias my job might be expected to give, aggravated by a phobia resulting from my recent sting, and he was wondering whether it might connote other, perhaps less harmless, unsoundness. "Look here," I suggested. "We've brought in 4 full loads between us. I just want enough space in one of them for these cases. If you think we can't spare that, I'll go out and find a trailer or another lorry." "No, leave them where they are. They don't take a lot of room," he decided. We went into the building and had some tea at an improvised canteen that a pleasant-faced middle-aged woman had competently set up there. "He thinks," I said to Josella, "that I've got a bee in my bonnet over Triffids."
"Oh, he'll learn, I'm afraid," she replied. "It's queer that no one else seems to have seen them about."
"Well, these people have all been keeping pretty much to the centre, so it's not very surprising. After all, we've seen none ourselves today."
"Do you think they'll come right down here among the streets?"
"I couldn't say. Maybe lost ones would."
"How do you think they got loose?" she asked.
"If they worry at a stake hard enough and long enough, it'll usually come in the end. The breakouts we used to get sometimes on the farms were due, as a rule, to their all crowding up against one section of the fence until it gave way."
"Couldn't you make the fences stronger?"
"We could have done, but we didn't want them fixed quite permanently. It didn't happen very often, and when it did, it was usually simply from one field to another, so we'd just drive them back and put up the fence again. I don't think any of them will intentionally make this way. From a Triffid point of view, a city must be much like a desert, so I should think they'll be moving outwards towards the open country on the whole. Have you ever used a Triffid gun?" I added. She shook her head. "After I've done something about these clothes, I was thinking of putting in a bit of practice if you'd like to try," I suggested. I got back an hour or so later feeling more suitably clad, as a result of having infringed on her idea of a ski suit and heavy shoes, to find that she had changed into a becoming dress of spring green. We took a couple of the Triffid guns and went out into the garden of Russell Square close by. We had spent about half an hour snipping the topmost shoots off convenient bushes when a young woman in a brick-red lumber jacket and an elegant pair of green trousers strolled across the grass and levelled a small camera at us.
"Who are you? The press?"
inquired Gisella.
"More or less," said the young woman. "At least, I'm the official record. Elspeth Carey."
"So soon," I remarked. I traced the hand of our order-conscious colonel.
"You're quite right," she agreed.
She turned to look at Josella.
"And you are Miss Playton. I've often wondered—"
"Now look here," interrupted Josella. "Why should the one static thing in a collapsing world be my reputation? Can't we forget it?"
Said Miss Carey thoughtfully. "Uh-huh." She turned to another subject.
"What's all this about Triffids?" she asked.
We told her.
"They think," added Josella, "that Bill here is either scary or scatty on the subject."
Miss Carey turned a straight look at me. Her face was interesting rather than good-looking, with a complexion browned by stronger suns than ours. Her eyes were steady, observant, and dark brown.
"Are you?" she asked.
"Well, I think they're troublesome enough to be taken seriously when they get out of hand," I told her. She nodded.
"True enough. I've been in places where they're out of hand. Quite nasty.
But in England? Well, it's hard to imagine that here." "There'll not be a lot to stop them here now," I said. Her reply, if she had been about to make one, was forestalled by the sound of an engine overhead. We looked up, and presently saw a helicopter come drifting across the roof of the British Museum.
"That'll be Ivan," said Miss Carey. "He thought he might manage to find one. I must go and get a picture of him landing. See you later."
And she hurried off across the grass. Gisella lay down, clasped her hands behind her head, and gazed up into the depths of the sky. When the helicopter's engine ceased, it sounded very much quieter than before we had heard it. I can't believe it, she said. I try, but I still can't really believe. It can't all be going. 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 This is some kind of dream. Tomorrow this garden will be full of noise. The red buses will be roaring along over there. Crowds of people will be scurrying along the pavements. The traffic lights will be flashing. A world doesn't just end like this. It can't. It isn't possible.
I was feeling like that, too. The houses, the trees, the absurdly grandiose hotels on the other side of the square were all too normal, too ready to come to life at a touch. And yet, I said, I suppose that if they had been able to think at all, the dinosaurs would have thought much the same thing. It just does happen from time to time, you see.
But why to us? It's like reading in the papers about the astonishing things that have happened to other people, but always to other people. There's nothing special about us.
Isn't there always a why me? Whether it's the soldier who's untouched when all his pals are killed, or the fellow who gets run in for fiddling his accounts. Just plain blind chance, I'd say.
Chance that it happened, or chance that it happened now?
Now, I mean, that was bound to happen sometime in some way. It's an unnatural thought that one type of creature should dominate perpetually.
I don't see why.
Why is a heck of a question. But it is an inescapable conclusion that life has to be dynamic and not static. Change is bound to come one way or another. Mind you, I don't think it's quite done with us this time, but it has had a damn good try.
Then you don't think it really is the end? Of people, I mean.
It might be. But, well, I don't think so. This time. It could be the end. I had no doubt of that. But there would be other little groups like ours. I saw an empty world with a few scattered communities trying to fight their way back to control of it. I had to believe that some, at least, of them would succeed. No, I repeated. It need not be the end. We're still very adaptable, and we've a flying start compared with our ancestors. As long as there are any of us left sound and healthy, we've got a chance, a thundering good chance. Gisella made no answer. She lay facing upwards with a faraway look in her eyes. I thought perhaps I could guess something of what was passing in her mind, but I said nothing. She did not speak for a little while, then she said,
You know, one of the most shocking things about it is to realize how easily we have lost a world that seemed so safe and certain.
She was quite right. It was that simplicity that seemed somehow to be the nucleus of the shock. From very familiarity, one forgets all the forces which keep the balance and thinks of security as normal. It is not. I don't think it had ever before occurred to me that man's supremacy is not primarily due to his brain, as most of the books would have one think. It is due to the brain's capacity to make use of the information conveyed to it by a narrow band of visible light rays. His civilization, all that he has achieved or might achieve, hangs upon his ability to perceive that range of vibrations from red to violet. Without that, he is lost. I saw for a moment the true tenuousness of his hold on his power, the miracles that he had wrought with such a fragile instrument. Gisella had been pursuing her own line of thought.
It's going to be a very queer sort of world. What's left of it? I don't think we're going to like it a lot, she said reflectively. It seemed to me an odd view to take, rather as if one should protest that one did not like the idea of dying or being born.
I prefer the notion of finding out first how it would be, and then doing what one could about the parts of it one disliked most, but I let it pass. From time to time we had heard the sound of lorries driving up to the far side of the building. It was evident that most of the foraging parties must have returned by this hour. I looked at my watch and reached for the Triffid guns lying on the grass beside me. If we're going to get any supper before we hear what other people feel about all this, it's time we went in, I said.
Chapter 7
Conference. I fancy all of us had expected the meeting to be simply a kind of briefing talk. Just times, course instructions, the day's objective, that kind of thing. Certainly I had no expectation of the food for thought that we received. It was held in a small lecture theatre lit for the occasion by an arrangement of car headlamps and batteries. When we went in, some half-dozen men and two women who appeared to have constituted themselves a committee were conferring behind the lecturer's desk. To our surprise, we found nearly 100 people seated in the body of the hall. Young women predominated at a ratio of about 4 to 1. I had not realized, until Josella pointed it out to me, how few of them were able to see. Michael Beadley dominated the consulting group by his height. I recognized the colonel beside him. The other faces were new to me, save that of Elspeth Carey, who had now exchanged her camera for a notebook, presumably for the benefit of posterity. Most of their interest was centered round an elderly man of ugly but benign aspect, who wore gold-rimmed spectacles and fine white hair trimmed to a rather political length. They all had an air of being a little worried about him. The other woman in the party was little more than a girl, perhaps 22 or 23. She did not appear happy at finding herself where she was. She cast occasional looks of nervous uncertainty at the audience. Sandra Telmont came in, carrying a sheet of foolscap. She studied it a moment, then briskly broke the group up and sorted it into chairs. With a wave of her hand, she directed Michael to the desk, and the meeting began. He stood there a little bent, watching the audience from somber eyes as he waited for the murmuring to die down. When he spoke, it was in a pleasant, practiced voice, and with a fireside manner. "Many of us here," he began, "must still be feeling numbed under this catastrophe. The world we knew has ended in a flash. Some of us may be feeling that it is the end of everything. It is not. But to all of you, I will say at once that it can be the end of everything, if we let it. Stupendous as this disaster is, there is still a margin of survival. It may be worth remembering just now that we are not unique in looking upon vast calamity. Whatever the myths that have grown up about it, there can be no doubt that somewhere far back in our history there was a great flood. Those who survived that must have looked upon a disaster comparable in scale with this, and in some ways more formidable. But they cannot have despaired. They must have begun again. As we can begin again. Self-pity and a sense of high tragedy are going to build nothing at all. So we had better throw them out at once, for it is builders that we must become. And further, to deflate any romantic dramatization, I would like to point out to you that this, even now, is not the worst that could have happened. I, and quite likely many of you, have spent most of our lives in expectation of something worse. And I still believe that if this had not happened to us, that worse thing would. From the 6th of August, 1945, the margin of survival has narrowed appallingly. Indeed, 2 days ago it was narrower than it is at this moment. If you need to dramatize, you could well take for your material the years succeeding 1945, when the path of safety started to shrink to a tightrope along which we had to walk, with our eyes deliberately closed to the depths beneath us. In any single moment of the year since then, the fatal slip might have been made. It is a miracle that it was not. It is a double miracle that can go on happening for years. But sooner or later that slip must have occurred. It would not have mattered whether it came through malice, carelessness, or sheer accident. The balance would have been lost, and the destruction let loose. How bad it would have been, we cannot say. How bad it could have been? Well, there might have been no survivors. There might possibly have been no planet. And now contrast our situation. The Earth is intact, unscarred, still fruitful. It can provide us with food and raw materials. We have repositories of knowledge that can teach us to do anything that has been done before, though there are some things that may be better unremembered. And we have the means, the health, and the strength
to begin to build again.
He did not make a long speech, but it had effect. It must have made quite a number of the members of his audience begin to feel that perhaps they were at the beginning of something after all, rather than at the end of everything. In spite of his offering little but generalities, there was a more alert air in the place when he sat down. The colonel, who followed him, was practical and factual. He reminded us that for reasons of health it would be advisable for us to get away from all built-up areas as soon as practicable, which was expected to be at about 1200 hours on the following day. Almost all the primary necessities, as well as extras enough to give a reasonable standard of comfort, had now been collected. In considering our stocks, our aim must be to make ourselves as nearly independent of outside sources as possible for a minimum of 1 year. We should spend that period in virtually a state of siege. There were, no doubt, many things we should all like to take besides those on our lists, but they would have to wait until the medical staff, and here the girl on the committee blushed deeply, considered it safe for parties to leave isolation and fetch them. As for the scene of our isolation, the committee had given it considerable thought, and bearing in mind the desiderata of compactness, self-sufficiency, and detachment, had come to the conclusion that a country boarding school, or, failing that, some large country mansion, would best serve our purposes. Whether the committee had in fact not yet decided on any particular place, or whether the military notion that secrecy has some intrinsic value persisted in the colonel's mind, I cannot say, but I have no doubt that his failure to name the place, or even the probable locality, was the gravest mistake made that evening. At the time, however, his practical manner had a further reassuring effect. As he sat down, Michael rose again. He spoke encouragingly to the girl, and then introduced her. It had, he said, been one of our greatest worries that we had no one among us with medical knowledge. Therefore, it was with great relief that he welcomed Miss Burr. It was true that she did not hold medical degrees with impressive letters, but she did have high nursing qualifications. For himself, he thought that knowledge recently attained might be worth more than degrees acquired years ago. The girl, blushing again, said a little piece about her determination to carry the job through, and ended a trifle abruptly with the information that she would inoculate us all against a variety of things before we left the hall. A small, sparrow-like man, whose name I did not catch, rubbed it in that the health of each was the concern of all, and that any suspicion of illness should be reported at once, since the effects of a contagious disease among us would be serious. When he had finished, Sandra rose and introduced the last speaker of the group, Dr. E. H. Vorlis, D.Sc. of Edinburgh, Professor of Sociology at the University of Kingston. The white-haired man walked to his desk. He stood there a few moments with his fingertips resting upon it, and his head bent down as if he were studying it. Those behind regarded him carefully with a trace of anxiety. The colonel leaned over to whisper something to Michael, who nodded without taking his eyes off the doctor. The old man looked up. He passed a hand over his hair.
"My friends," he said, "I think I may claim to be the oldest among you. In nearly 70 years I have learned and had to unlearn many things, though not nearly so many as I could have wished. But if, in the course of a long study of man's institutions, one thing has struck me more than their stubbornness, it is their variety. Well, indeed, do the French say, autre temps, autre mœurs. We must all see, if we pause to think, that one kind of community's virtue may well be another kind of community's crime, that what is frowned upon here may be considered laudable elsewhere, that customs condemned in one century are condoned in another. And we must also see that in each community and each period there is a widespread belief in the moral rightness of its own customs. Now, clearly, since many of these beliefs conflict, they cannot all be right in an absolute sense. The most judgment one can pass on them, if one has to pass judgments at all, is to say that they have at some period been right for those communities that hold them. It may be that they still are, but it frequently is found that they are not, and that the communities who continue to follow them blindly without heed to changed circumstances do so to their own disadvantage, perhaps to their ultimate destruction.
The audience did not perceive where the introduction might be leading. It fidgeted. Most of it was accustomed when it encountered this kind of thing to turn the radio off at once. Now it felt trapped. The speaker decided to make himself clearer.
"Thus," he continued, "you would not expect to find the same manners, customs, and forms in a penurious Indian village living on the edge of starvation as you would in, say, Mayfair. Similarly, the people in a warm country where life is easy are going to differ quite a deal from the people of an overcrowded, hard-working country as to the nature of the principal virtues. In other words, different environments set different standards. I point this out to you because the world we knew is gone. Finished. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone with it. Our needs are now different, and our aims must be different. If you want an example, I would suggest to you that we have all spent the day indulging with perfectly easy consciences in what 2 days ago would have been housebreaking and theft. With the old pattern broken, we have now to find out what mode of life is best suited to the new. We have not simply to start building again. We have to start thinking again, which is much more difficult and far more distasteful. Man remains physically adaptable to a remarkable degree, but it is the custom of each community to form the minds of its young in a mould, introducing a binding agent of prejudice. The result is a remarkably tough substance capable of withstanding successfully even the pressure of many innate tendencies and instincts. In this way, it has been possible to produce a man who, against all his basic sense of self-preservation, will voluntarily risk death for an ideal, but also in this way is produced the dolt who is sure of everything and knows what is right. In the time now ahead of us, a great many of these prejudices we have been taught will have to go, or be radically altered. We can accept and retain only one primary prejudice, and that is that the race is worth preserving. To that consideration, all else will for a time at least be subordinate. We must look at all we do with the question in mind, is this going to help our race survive, or will it hinder us? If it will help, we must do it, whether or not it conflicts with the ideas in which we were brought up. If not, we must avoid it even though the omission may clash with our previous notions of duty and even of justice. It will not be easy. Old prejudices die hard. The simple rely on a bolstering mass of maxim and precept. So do the timid, so do the mentally lazy, and so do all of us, more than we imagine. Now that the organization has gone, our ready reckoners for conduct within it no longer give the right answers. We must have the moral courage to think and to plan for ourselves.
He paused to survey his audience thoughtfully. Then he said,
"There is one thing to be made quite clear to you before you decide to join our community. It is that those of us who start on this task will all have our parts to play. The men must work. The women must have babies. Unless you can agree to that, there can be no place for you in our community."
After an interval of dead silence, he added,
"We can afford to support a limited number of women who cannot see, because they will have babies who can see. We cannot afford to support men who cannot see. In our new world, then, babies become very much more important than husbands."
For some seconds after he stopped speaking, silence continued, Then isolated murmurs grew quickly into a general buzz. I looked at Gisella. To my astonishment, she was grinning impishly. "What do you find funny about this?" I asked, a trifle shortly.
"People's expressions, mostly," she replied.
I had to admit it as a reason. I looked round the place and then across at Michael. His eyes were moving from one section to another of the audience as he tried to sum up the reaction. "Michael's looking a bit anxious," I observed.
"He should worry," said Gisella. "If Brigham Young could bring it off in the middle of the 19th century, this ought to be a pushover."
"What a crude young woman you are at times," I said. "Were you in on this before?"
"Not exactly, but I'm not quite dumb, you know.
Besides, while you were away, someone drove in a bus with most of these blind girls on board. They all came from some institution. I said to myself, why collect them from there when you could gather up thousands in a few streets round here? The answer, obviously, was that, A, being blind before this happened, they had all been trained to do work of some kind, and B, they were all girls. The deduction wasn't terribly difficult."
"Hmm," I said. "Depends on one's outlook, I suppose. I must say it wouldn't have struck me.
Do you—" "Shh," she told me, as a quietness came over the hall. A tall, dark, purposeful-looking youngish woman had risen. While she waited, she appeared to have a mouth not made to open.
"Are we to understand," she inquired, using a kind of carbon-steel voice, "are we to understand that the last speaker is advocating free love?"
And she sat down with spine-jarring decision. Dr. Vorless smoothed back his hair as he regarded her.
"I think the questioner must be aware that I never mentioned love, free, bought, or battered. Will she please make her question clearer?"
The woman stood up again.
"I think the speaker understood me. I am asking if he suggests the abolition of the marriage law."
"The laws we knew have been abolished by circumstances. It now falls to us to make laws suitable to the conditions and to enforce them if necessary."
"There is still God's law and the law of decency."
"Madam, Solomon had 300, or was it 500, wives, and God did not apparently hold that against him. A Mohammedan preserves rigid respectability with 3 wives. These are matters of local custom. Just what our laws in these matters and in others will be is for us all to decide later for the greatest benefit of the community. This committee, after discussion, has decided that if we are to build a new state of things and avoid a relapse into barbarism, which is an appreciable danger, we must have certain undertakings from those who wish to join us. Not one of us is going to recapture the conditions we have lost. What we offer is a busy life and the best conditions we can contrive, and the happiness which will come of achievement against odds. In return, we ask willingness and fruitfulness. There is no compulsion. The choice is yours. Those to whom our offer does not appeal are at perfect liberty to go elsewhere and start a separate community on such lines as they prefer. But I would ask you to consider very carefully whether or not you do hold a warrant from God to deprive any woman of the happiness of carrying out her natural functions."
The discussion which followed was a rambling affair, descending frequently to points of detail and hypothesis on which there could as yet be no answers. But there was no move to cut it short. The longer it went on, the less strangeness the idea would have. Gisella and I moved over to the table where Nurse Burr had set up her paraphernalia. We took several shots in our arms, and then sat down again to listen to the wrangling.
"How many of them will decide to come, do you think?" I asked her.
She glanced round.
"Nearly all of them, by the morning," she said.
I felt doubtful. There was a lot of objecting and questioning going on. Gisella said,
If you were a woman who was going to spend an hour or two before you went to sleep tonight considering whether you would choose babies and an organization to look after you, or adherence to a principle which might quite likely mean no babies and no one to look after you, you'd not really be very doubtful, you know. And after all, most women want babies anyway. The husband's just what Dr. Vorlis might call the local means to the end. It's rather cynical of you. If you really think that cynical, you must be a very sentimental character. I'm talking about real women, not those in the magazine, movie, make-believe world.
Oh, I said. She sat pensively a while, and gradually acquired a frown. At last she said,
The thing that worries me is how many will they expect? I like babies, all right, but there are limits.
After the debate had gone on raggedly for an hour or so, it was wound up. Michael asked that the names of all those willing to join in his plan should be left in his office by 10 o'clock the next morning. The colonel requested all who could drive a lorry to report to him by 7:00, and the meeting broke up. Josella and I wandered out of doors. The evening was mild. The light on the tower was again stabbing hopefully into the sky. The moon had just risen clear of the museum roof. We found a low wall and sat on it, looking into the shadows of the square garden and listening to the faint sound of the wind in the branches of the trees there. We smoked a cigarette each, almost in silence. When I reached the end of mine, I threw it away and drew a breath. Josella, I said.
Hmm?
She replied, scarcely emerging from her thoughts. Josella, I said again, those babies, I'd be sort of terribly proud and happy if they could be mine as well as yours. She sat quite still for a moment, saying nothing. Then she turned her head. The moonlight was glinting on her fair hair, but her face and eyes were in shadow. I waited with a hammered and slightly sick feeling inside me. She said with surprising calm,
Thank you, Bill, dear. I think I would, too.
I sighed. The hammering did not ease up much, and I saw that my hand was trembling as it reached for hers. I didn't have any words for the moment. Josella, however, did. She said, But it isn't quite as easy as that now. I was jolted.
What do you mean?
I asked.
She said, consideringly, I think that if I were those people in there...
She nodded in the direction of the tower.
I think that I should make a rule. I should divide us up into lots. I should say every man who marries a sighted girl must take on 2 blind girls as well. I'm pretty sure that's what I should do.
I stared at her face in the shadow.
You don't mean that, I protested. I'm afraid I do, Bill. But look here, don't you think they may have had some idea like that in their minds from what they've been saying?
Not unlikely, I conceded.
But if they make the rule, that's one thing. I don't see... You mean you don't love me enough to take on 2 other women as well?
I swallowed.
I also objected. Look here, this is all crazy. It's unnatural. What you're suggesting...
She put up a hand to stop me.
Just listen to me, Bill. I know it sounds a bit startling at first, but there's nothing crazy about it. It's all quite clear. And it's not very easy. All this...
She waved her hand around...
It's done something to me. It's like suddenly seeing everything differently. And one of the things I think I see is that those of us who get through are going to be much nearer to one another, more dependent on one another, more like, well, more like a tribe than we ever were before. All day long as we went about, I've been seeing unfortunate people who are going to die very soon. And all the time I've been saying to myself, there but for the grace of God. And then I've told myself, this is a miracle. I don't deserve anything better than any of these people. But it has happened. Here I still am. So now,
it's up to me to justify it.
Somehow, it's made me feel closer to other people than I have ever done before. That's made me keep wondering all the time what I can do to help some of them. You see, we must do something to justify that miracle, Bill. I might have been any of those blind girls. You might have been any of these wandering men. There's nothing big we can do. But if we try to look after just a few and give them what happiness we can, we shall be paying back a little, just a tiny part of what we owe. You do see that, don't you, Bill?
I turned it over in my mind for a minute or more.
I think, I said, that that's the queerest argument I've heard today, if not ever. And yet it's right. Isn't it, Bill?
I know it's right. I tried to put myself in the place of one of those blind girls, and I know. We hold the chance of as full a life as they can have, for some of them. Shall we give it them as part of our gratitude? Or shall we simply withhold it on account of the prejudices we've been taught? That's what it amounts to.
I sat silently for a time. I had not a moment's doubt that Josella meant every word she said. I ruminated a little on the ways of purposeful, subversive-minded women like Florence Nightingale and Elizabeth Fry. You can't do anything with such women. And they so often turn out to have been right after all.
Very well, I said at last. If that's the way you think it ought to be. But I hope...
She cut me short.
Oh, Bill, I knew you'd understand. Oh, I'm glad. So very glad. You've made me so happy.
After a time...
I hope...
I began again. Josella patted my hand.
You won't need to worry at all, my dear. I shall choose two nice, sensible girls.
Oh, I said. We went on sitting there on the wall, hand in hand, looking at the dappled trees, but not seeing them very much. At least I wasn't. Then in the building behind us, someone started up a gramophone playing a Strauss waltz. It was painfully nostalgic as it lilted through the empty courtyard. For an instant, the road before us became the ghost of a ballroom, a swirl of colour, with the moon for a crystal chandelier. Josella slid off the wall. With her arms outstretched, her wrists and fingers rippling, her body swaying, she danced, light as a thistledown in a big circle in the moonlight. She came round to me, her eyes shining and her arms beckoning. And we danced, on the brink of an unknown future, to an echo from a vanished past.
Chapter 8. Frustration.
I was walking through an unknown deserted city where a bell rang dismally, and a sepulchral disembodied voice called in the emptiness, "The beast is loose. Beware. The beast is loose."
When I woke to find that a bell really was ringing, it was a handbell that jangled with a brassy double clatter so harsh and startling that for a moment I could not remember where I was. Then, as I sat up still bemused, there came a sound of voices calling, "Fire!" I jumped just as I was from my blankets and ran into the corridor. There was a smell of smoke there, a noise of hurried feet, doors banging. Most of the sound seemed to come from my right, where the bell kept on clanging and the frightened voices were calling. So it was that way I turned and ran. A little moonlight filtered in through tall windows at the end of the passage, relieving the dimness just enough for me to keep to the middle of the way and avoid the people who were feeling their way along the walls. I reached the stairs. The bell was still clanging in the hall below. I made my way down as fast as I could through smoke that grew thicker. Near the bottom I tripped and fell forward. The dimness became a sudden darkness into which a light burst like a cloud of needles. And that was all. The first thing was an ache in my head. The next was a glare when I opened my eyes. At the first blink, it was as dazzling as a Klieg light, but when I started again and edged the lids up more cautiously, it turned out to be only an ordinary window, and grimy at that. I knew I was lying on a bed, but I did not sit up to investigate further. There was a piston pounding away in my head that discouraged any kind of movement. So I lay there quietly and studied the ceiling, until I discovered that my wrists were tied together. That snapped me out of my lethargy in spite of the thumping head. I found it a very neat job, not painfully tight, but perfectly efficient. Several turns of insulated wire on each wrist, and a complex knot on the far side where it was impossible for me to reach it with my teeth. I swore a bit and looked around. The room was small, and save for the bed on which I lay, empty.
"Hey!" I called. "Anybody around here?"
After half a minute or so, there was a shuffle of feet outside. The door was opened, and a head appeared. It was a small head with a tweed cap at the top of it. It had a stringy-looking choker beneath, and a dark unshavenness across its face. It was not turned straight at me, but in my general direction.
"Hello, cock," it said, amiably enough. "So you've come too, have you? Hang on a bit, I'll get you a cup of char."
And it vanished again. The instruction to hang on was superfluous, but I did not have to wait long. In a few minutes he returned, carrying a wire-handled can with some tea in it.
"Where are you?"
he said. "Straight ahead of you, on the bed," I told him. He groped forward with his left hand until he found the foot of the bed, then he felt his way around it and held out the can.
"Here you are, chum. It'll taste a bit funny-like, because old Charlie put a shot of rum in it, but I reckon you'll not mind that."
I took it from him, holding it with some difficulty between my bound hands. It was strong and sweet, and the rum hadn't been stinted. The taste might be queer, but it worked like the elixir of life itself.
"Thanks," I said. "You're a miracle worker. My name's Bill."
His, it seemed, was Alf.
"What's the line, Alf? What goes on here?" I asked him.
He sat down on the side of the bed and held out a packet of cigarettes with a box of matches. I took one, lit his first, then my own, and gave him back the box.
"It's this way, mate," he said. "You know there was a bit of a shindy up at the university yesterday morning. Maybe he was there."
I told him I'd seen it.
"Well, after that lot, Coker, he's the chap that did the talking, he got kind of peeved. 'Okay,' he says, nasty-like. 'The buggers have asked for it. I put it to them fair and square in the first place. Now they can take what's coming to them.' Well, we'd met up with a couple of other fellas and one old girl what can still see, and I fixed it all up between them. He's a lad, that Coker."
"You mean he framed the whole business? There wasn't any fire or anything?" I asked.
"Fire, my Aunt Fanny. What they done was fix up a tripwire or two, light a lot of paper and sticks in the hall, and start ringing the old bell. We reckon that them as could see would be the first along, on account of them being a bit of light still from the moon, and sure enough they was. Coker and another chap was giving them the KOs they tripped and passing them along to some of us chaps to carry out the lorry. Simplest kiss your hand."
"Hmm," I said ruefully. "Sounds efficient, that Coker. How many of us mugs fell into that little trap?"
"I'd say we got a couple of dozen, though it turned out as five or six of them was blinded. When we'd laid it up about all we'd room for in the lorry, we beat it and left the rest to sort themselves out."
End of disc 4.